So welcome, everyone. Today is March 22nd, 2017, Imagery International teleseminar for Fighting Compassion Fatigue tonight with Marette Monson. Am I saying your, how do you say your last name?
Monson.
Monson. Oh, good. I said it right. Okay, great.
You did.
This is Maureen, and I am the membership chair and also the administrator for II. And I just have a couple of very brief announcements. One is that our conference, which will be happening this fall, October 21st, 22nd, will be fabulous because all of our conferences are fabulous. Like, I've gone, I think, to 4 years now, and every year I think that one was the best conference ever. So finally, I just over it because, you know, last year I'm like, it just can't be topped. This is just the best. So I just know that all of our conferences are just fabulous. We draw fabulous people to us. They're creative. They're smart. They're compassionate. They're just a great, great group of people. And as you may or may not know, this year's theme, we actually kind of put more of a theme on it this year than we've done other years, and it's going to be on mind-body imagery. And so I'm saying this because the call for proposals, which we hope you have considered seriously, submitting a proposal for that, it ends in just a few days on March 24th. So please, even if you know, maybe you're not sure it's right, go ahead and just submit a proposal, because you never know. I mean, we're a creative bunch, and it doesn't have to be, you know, exactly to the letter of the mind-body, but there may be some connection. So I invite you to do that. And before I introduce Marette, because we're Imagery International, let's all do a very brief imagery together. So let's just close our eyes for a moment and take some breaths. And let your out-breath be a little longer than your in-breath. And I want you to imagine that we're all in a circle together, all of us here for this conference call on compassion fatigue. And we've got Marette at the head, and we're all in a big circle around her. And with regard to compassion fatigue, one of the things is just unplugging from the energies of the day and just imagining, even today and now, if there has been a recent interaction that you've had that maybe you need to unplug from that, and maybe you could visualize that connection as a cord, an energetic cord that may have come from that person either tapping into your energy and being dependent on you, or you even them. And just check, and you can look at your root chakra, your sit bone, and just see if at the base of your spine, just call back any cords that you may have sent out to plug into others. And just gently tug them back and know that your energy knows where it belongs and it wants to come home, letting it come all the way back into you, and vice versa if others may have plugged into you. Some of this is done unintentionally, and if they've plugged into you, to just gently tug at their cord and pull it out, so that it can no longer expend your energy, and let it go zipping back to that person because their energy is eager to join them. Just coming back to our circle, feeling more whole and complete, and just grounding yourself on the ground to be solid and sturdy. Just coming back from our imagery, I am so pleased that Marette joins us tonight. so interested to hear and learn about this topic, which I know nothing about. Merett is a licensed social worker and an MBA, and she has a private practice in the state of Utah. She is also a certified compassion fatigue educator from the Figley Institute. She is the only certified expert in compassion fatigue and resiliency in the United States. Well, I think we have to do something about that.
There's a few that are in training right now, so
wow.
Won't be the only for long.
All right. Well, Merett's training in compassion fatigue has been with internationally recognized leader J. Eric Gentry, who is co-developer of the Accelerated Recovery Program for Compassion Fatigue. This program has been demonstrated as a powerful, effective treatment for the symptoms of compassion fatigue. And also, I want to say congratulations to you, Merett. I understand the workbook on professional resilience you've been working on will be coming out this spring.
Yes, it will. I'm really excited. This is the first book that I've written, and we've written it so that it's workbook format so that people can buy it and then do the exercises and be able to heal themselves from compassion fatigue. So,
excited. So this is for practitioners then?
Yes. Yes.
Fantastic. Well, I turn it over to you, Merett.
Great. Thank you, Maureen. Hello, everyone. In 1945, the horrors of World War II saw hundreds of war survivors. Thousands of these traumatized survivors flocked to mental health providers in an effort to find relief from symptoms of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, at this time, leaders in the field of mental health saw this as an opportunity to bring legitimacy to mental health therapy. So they followed the progress of these war victims and soldiers very closely. When the war victims began to complain that their symptoms were not getting better, mental health leaders decided to discover why the treatment that they invented wasn't actually working, and what they discovered shocked them. They found that the mental health providers who had not experienced firsthand horrors of war were now experiencing the same trauma symptoms as their clients. And as a result, the providers had stopped encouraging their clients to talk about their trauma for fear of traumatizing themselves. Mental health leaders were now faced with the fact that a person does not have to directly experience trauma to be traumatized. Simply hearing stories about trauma firsthand from survivors creates trauma for the listener. And these symptoms are called secondary traumatic stress disorder or vicarious trauma. And the unconscious desire to keep clients from talking about trauma because of your own reaction to it is known as the silencing response. And both of these things are often measured today. Thank you for joining me for today's discussion on compassion fatigue, burnout, and secondary traumatic stress disorder, because by being aware of these conditions and understanding how to treat them and how to prevent them, you will find that you can hear the traumatic stories of the people that you work with without any negative effects on you. Now, the negative effects of being a caregiver to traumatized populations were gradually ignored in the years following World War II. And that's partly because they were trying to establish the medical model of objectivity during that time. And so the belief was that if you just interacted with someone who was traumatized with objectiveness without getting emotionally attached, you wouldn't be traumatized. We know today that that's not true. But with the start of the Vietnam War, there was a surge in trauma prevention and treatment again in mental health. Charles Figley was a student at that time, and he began working with Vietnam veterans who were experiencing post-traumatic stress. And he started to notice exactly what the mental health leaders during World War II did, that the other members of his treatment team also began experiencing trauma symptoms from their work. when he got older and got his PhD, he decided to study that phenomenon, and he coined the phrase compassion fatigue. His first book on the subject was published in 1995, and it's called Compassion Fatigue, Secondary Traumatic Stress Disorders from Treating the Traumatized. Since 1995, Figley and his students and colleagues have studied and published hundreds of books and articles on the subject. Not only did they create measurement tools, but Figley's student, Dr. Eric Gentry, created a treatment for compassion fatigue called the Accelerated Recovery Program, or ARP, which has been validated through research as the only effective treatment for helping professionals. I was fortunate that Dr. Gentry met with me 2 years ago and chose me to teach and mentor in the ARP. And I've been treating helping professionals from my clinic in Salt Lake City, Utah, ever since. Today, I'm honored to be able to introduce you to some aspects of the ARP and share with you a few tips for treatment and prevention. And I wanted to thank Maureen and Imagery International for giving me this opportunity. Compassion fatigue, as Charles Figley defined it, refers to the emotional and physical exhaustion that can affect helping professionals and caregivers over time. I've started to notice it in caregivers as well, people who take care of elderly parents, people with disabilities, etc., and even some business professionals. Compassion fatigue has been associated with a gradual desensitization to client stories, a decrease in quality care for clients, an increase in clinical errors. In fact, research has shown that every single instance of ethical violations involved compassion fatigue symptoms. It also has been associated with higher rates of depression and anxiety among helpers and rising rates of stress in the workplace climate. Helping professionals have also found that their empathy and ability to connect with their loved ones and friends is impacted by compassion fatigue, and I think this is probably one of the greatest symptoms that I see. This in turn leads to increased rates of stress in the household, divorce, and social isolation. I've had several people tell me that they lost their marriage and other relationships because of compassion fatigue. And this is the most insidious aspect of it, because it attacks the very core of what brings helpers into this work, their ability to have empathy and compassion for others. In fact, in 2013, the American Psychological Association found that rates of depression among their members was 4 times higher than rates among the actual clients that they worked with. 4 times higher. And these are psychologists. If you have access to the handout that was provided with this lecture, you will find a list of compassion fatigue symptoms. So I want you to take a moment and look over that list. There were so many that it would be difficult for me to talk about each one. So just look at that list for a moment. Five or more symptoms on this list could indicate that you are experiencing compassion fatigue. And that's not five in one category. That's five total across all categories on that list. Now, this is not a definitive measure. It's just a list of symptoms. The definitive assessment is actually called the Professional Quality of Life Scale. And this scale can be found on the internet for free. There's a website called proqol.org. Yes, proqol.org. It stands for Professional Quality of Life Scale. And you can go to that website and download this scale. And I recommend that every helping professional take this assessment at least once per year so they can measure where they're at with their compassion fatigue symptoms. I also recommend that it shouldn't be included as part of the workplace because individuals are often afraid that they won't receive a promotion or things like that if their boss thinks that they're too burned out for it, when in fact it might actually be a good idea. So it should just be done at home. And good news is that there's no cost for this assessment other than the 5 minutes of your time that it will take. Now, it's important to be aware that compassion fatigue is caused by the act of helping others. It is not caused by a personal weakness, and it is not caused by difficult work environments, although those two things are often implicated by people experiencing symptoms. Compassion fatigue happens to all of us at some point in our careers, even if we're working in the best environments and are extremely emotionally resilient. Some of the most recent numbers say as little as 55% to as many as 80% of us have it at one period of time or another. A key defining characteristic of compassion fatigue is that the sufferer still cares about their clients and their job. They experience a great deal of guilt when they cannot perform their jobs adequately because of the symptoms that they're experiencing. And while compassion fatigue is not related to your environment, burnout is. Often people talk about feeling burned out, but it is important that we differentiate between compassion fatigue, burnout, and secondary traumatic stress disorder, because the treatment for all three is different. Burnout happens when the perceived demands of your work environment exceed your perceived resources to meet those demands. I'll say that one more time. Burnout happens when the perceived demands of your work environment exceed your perceived resources to meet those demands. So what happens is that you feel like you need to be able to provide a service, but you're unable to because you don't have the tools, the location, the time, the money. There are some barriers in the way. And when unable to meet those demands because of these environmental barriers, a helping professional begins to disengage, and they lose their compassion and empathy for their clients as a way of coping with this barrier, because it's the only way that they can continue to do their job and not feel bad about not meeting those needs. So they just stop caring. And they even stop feeling guilty about the quality of the care that they're providing. A person who is burned out can go on vacation away from work and come back feeling refreshed, because they were not worried at all about the work while they were away. They have emotionally disconnected from their job. But a person with compassion fatigue can take a vacation and come back even more stressed because they're worried about their work the whole time that they were gone. Secondary traumatic stress occurs when a person has intrusive symptoms. These symptoms include three things: a heightened sense of anxiety, avoidance behaviors about the work, and the intrusive symptoms. Some examples include things like thinking about work or clients or the things that they told you when you are doing non-work activities. An example I like to use is if you're shopping in the grocery store and you're looking over the produce, and you're picking up a head of cabbage, and suddenly you're thinking about a story that a client told you. And you shouldn't be thinking about that at the moment. You should be thinking about that head of cabbage. That's an intrusive symptom. Intrusive symptoms also include nightmares. Feeling on edge when walking into work is a heightened sense of anxiety. Or feeling on edge just before meeting with a particular client is also a heightened sense of anxiety that comes with the secondary traumatic stress. And then last, avoiding tasks that are related to a particular case, such as avoiding returning phone calls or avoiding doing paperwork or even avoiding talking about trauma, a particular trauma with a client, that silencing response we mentioned earlier, are all avoidance tasks that are related to secondary traumatic stress disorder. So if you find that you are experiencing these kinds of symptoms, it will be important for you to seek help from a professional to resolve them, who can use professional trauma resolving techniques like EMDR. It's not something that you can do on yourself. But you do not have to suffer those symptoms. They can be completely resolved. It is possible that a person can have compassion fatigue, burnout, and secondary traumatic stress all at the same time. In fact, I see that most frequently. And each are treated in different ways. Today we're going to talk about compassion fatigue and how it's treated. So compassion fatigue is treated by developing what Dr. Gentry likes to call antibodies. Now an antibody is something that allows you to be exposed to things that cause illness, but it protects you from getting sick. So compassion fatigue antibodies allow you to work in any environment with any client without experiencing compassion fatigue symptoms, and that's pretty cool. The first and most important antibody is called self-regulation, and if you look on the handout I sent you a slide that shows all five antibodies. Self-regulation is the first one, and it's considered a primary antibody because it's the most powerful, and without it, none of the others will work. Self-regulation is your ability to calm your body down while in the presence of a perceived threat. I will say that again. Self-regulation is your ability to calm your body down while in the presence of a perceived threat. You see, our bodies have a built-in system that many of you are familiar with called the sympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system sends chemicals through our bodies that are designed to shut down certain parts of our body and divert the energy to other parts. This extra energy is diverted to our muscles, to our heart, and to our lungs in order to give us the strength and stamina that we will need to run away from danger, to stay and fight it to the death, or to freeze where we are and play dead so that the danger will pass us by. We call that the fight, flight, or freeze response. In order to get your heart and your lungs and your muscles the energy they need to do that, certain systems are shut down. These systems include our digestive system. So that's why people talk about experiencing butterflies in their stomach when they're nervous or feel fearful or feeling a threat, or they throw up or they're not hungry, because the digestive system shuts down. Other systems that shut down include our memory centers, our language centers, our impulse control centers, and our empathy and compassion centers. Now, why would our body shut down our empathy and compassion centers when we perceive a threat? Well, because it doesn't want you to feel sorry for the danger, for the person who's going to cause you harm. It wants you to do anything you can to get away, even if it includes hurting someone else, and not feel bad about it. So it intentionally shuts those off. Now, can you imagine doing your job if your language, your empathy, compassion, and memory were offline? It would be very difficult to do. But it actually happens much more than you are aware. Because, you see, perceived threats don't just come from life or death physical encounters. When was the last time you actually had one of those? They happen quite rarely. Only 2% of our perceived threats come from fear of physically being hurt. The other 98% of our perceived threats are threats to our ego. Ego. What do I mean by ego? Well, let me give you an example. So I'm working with this client who's a challenge to work with. They want their problem to be fixed, and they have made it clear that they think it's my responsibility to do so. Yet, what I'm doing with them isn't working as well as I thought, or as well as they thought. So I'm afraid that they will leave my session disappointed and even tell others that I don't know what I'm doing, and that might actually impact my future business. So there it is, the threat to my ego. A threat like this will activate my sympathetic nervous system. It will release the chemicals in my body, and before I know it, my ability to do my job is impaired. And I end up fumbling over my words with them, or I'm unable to empathize well, or I say something impulsively that came into my head that I shouldn't, or I can't remember details from their last visit, and I look like I'm not doing a quality job. Afterward, I might avoid doing paperwork related to their case or even delay returning their phone calls, some of those avoidance symptoms that we talked about earlier. But we put ourselves in positions of perceived threat intentionally in order to do our jobs. We know that we hear scary stuff. We know that our clients may not be totally stable and rational in the way that they perceive things. That's why they're coming to see us, to change that. We know that the human mind is complex, and just because it worked with one client doesn't mean that what I do is going to work with another. But we do this work because somebody has to. Somebody has to do it in order to help these clients heal. So in order to find satisfaction in our work, we need to be able to be in the presence of a perceived threat to our ego, because they will happen, and be able to calm our bodies down so that our sympathetic nervous system reaction will stop, and we can do our job with the utmost quality that it deserves. And this is self-regulation. So how do we regulate our bodies so that they are calm when we are interacting with our clients at all times? Well, what we do is we relax, and we relax often, and we relax in the presence of our clients. Many people are great at relaxing before and after a client interaction. They participate in mindfulness or yoga or other things. That's great. Keep doing that. But self-regulation is about relaxing in the presence of a perceived threat while you're in doing something that you think might be dangerous. So how do you relax while you're talking to your clients? Well, relaxing your muscles, of course, works best. There's a nerve in your body. It's called the vagus nerve. It's the largest nerve in your body, and it's also a two-way nerve, so it can give commands to the brain. When the muscles around the vagus nerve are relaxed, your entire body relaxes. There are two places in your body where the muscles are wrapped tightly around the vagus nerve. One is in the roof of your mouth, and the other is in your pelvic floor. How do you relax the muscles in the roof of your mouth? Well, you do it every day. It's by yawning. Stretching your mouth really wide stretches those muscles out, and then when you close your mouth, it releases them, which is relaxing. I actually hope that you have been yawning through my presentation, because that tells me that you are relaxed and not perceiving me as a threat. And I tell my clients that in my office. So it's funny, when I yawn, they don't mind either, because they're like, oh, you don't see me as a threat. And I'm like, nope, because I don't. So people can fake yawn all the time. So what I want you to do is just note the tightness and tension in your body right now and give it a rating on a scale of 1 to 10. And now I want you to take 3 big yawns and fake it if you have to, but they'll eventually turn into real ones. Now notice the difference in your body. Notice how it relaxes immediately after that yawn. Now, we can't always yawn in front of our clients unless their eyes are closed, but it really is a good excuse. You can always say, oh, I'm tired, to justify that. So the second area is in your pelvic floor. These are the muscles that are located between your hip bones and the bones that you sit on. And you use these muscles to stop and start bowel movements. So for a minute, try to focus on this area of your body. If you can't identify where that is, think about the muscles that you use to start and stop bowel movements. If you can relax this area, your whole body will relax. And you can relax them just by paying attention and thinking about it. That's all. So take a minute and think about it. Now I want you to notice the difference in your body. Now, if you're somebody who's anxious a lot, it will take practice to be able to relax those muscles, and I recommend that you do. It's one of the most powerful ways to relax your body in the presence of a conversation with someone without them knowing. A third way to relax your body without people knowing is to activate your peripheral vision. Activate your peripheral vision. So when you're anxious, your vision narrows, and it does that on purpose because it wants you to just focus on the danger. As you widen your vision, your body will calm and shut off the sympathetic nervous system. So to do this, you just pick a point, anything that you want, and look at it while keeping your head straight forward. And then widen your vision and see if you can allow things on the sides to come into clearer focus while not moving your head. And as you do that, I want you to notice what happens inside your body. It calms and relaxes. So you can be having a conversation with someone, still looking straight ahead at them, but then actually focusing on things in your peripheral vision for just a brief moment to relax and calm your body. There are many other ways to relax. Those are just a few to get started with, but keep that in mind as you're working with clients. Now, the second compassion fatigue antibody is called intentionality. If self-regulation is the heart of compassion fatigue resiliency, then intentionality is the soul. Intentionality is the ability to choose our reactions to all work situations such that they are congruent with what we value. Now, we have discovered that all professionals who are experiencing compassion fatigue and burnout are in what we call habitual breach of their integrity. Now, a breach of integrity occurs when a person acts impulsively or compulsively in the context of a perceived threat in order to get away from that threat. Now, this action has to be in violation of their values and personal caregiving mission for it to be a breach of integrity. Let me give you an example of what I mean. So I really believe in being responsive to my clients. I like to return phone calls the same day or the next day, and I like to do the same thing for emails. I think that even if I can't help them, I really believe that it's my duty to at least respond to them and let them know that I can't help them so that they're not worried and wondering. I really value that in my work a lot. But when I'm getting overwhelmed, which is a threat to my ego, suddenly I start putting off responding for another day or two and sometimes even a week. So this is a breach of my integrity. Because I'm breaching my integrity, I feel guilty that I haven't been as responsive to my clients as they need. And the guilt creates emotional drain, which creates compassion fatigue. So what we encourage you to do is be aware of what your work values are. They're not going to be the same as mine. You might value being generous, or you might value being timely, or you might value being kind with your clients. Identify at least three different things that you really feel strongly about and value, and write them down. Put them in a place where you can see them regularly. Then, as you are relaxing your body in the presence of a threat, you will be able to intentionally choose how you're going to respond to that client in a way that is congruent with those three values. Then even if the situation doesn't go as you planned, you won't feel guilty because you can say, well, I handled it according to my values. I did the best that I could. I don't have any regrets. And that's what decreases compassion fatigue. Now, the third antibody is called perceptual maturation. So I want you to take a moment and think about the perceptions you had about this work on your very first day. I don't know, maybe this is your second day, But now I want you to think about how those perceptions have changed since then, since your first day. You see, our perceptions mature over time in ways that help us cope better with challenges at work. And we have found a few perception shifts that are extremely helpful at blocking compassion fatigue. And those people who have antibodies accept and embrace these new perceptions. I'm going to share with you just a few of those new perceptions. So have you ever felt like you were being pulled from one crisis to another? People describe this as like putting out fires all day. Have you ever had one of those days, whether work or not? I know that I have. Well, feeling forced or trapped is a precursor to developing a trauma disorder. So what we want to do is, instead of feeling forced to help one thing or another, or trapped, being pulled from one crisis to another, we shift our perception to think, there are no demands placed on me. I am always at choice. And what this means is that no one is making you run from fire to fire. You're doing that with your own choice. No one is making you talk to that client. No one is making you take that phone call. And no one is making you do your paperwork. Now, I know some of you are saying, but Marette, but my boss is making me do it. Or the insurance company is making me do it. Or my kid is making me do it. And I say, no, that's not true. They're not making you do it. You can choose not to do those things. And you'll face the consequences if you don't. You might get fired. You might lose clients. Your kid will never forgive you. And you might not like those consequences. So you're choosing to do the tasks to avoid the consequences, or you're choosing to do the task to create positive consequences that you will like. But it doesn't matter, because in all cases, it's still your choice. And you always keep that power to choose with you, no matter what you do. So when I'm in a really difficult, stressful time with a lot of things to do, I think, well, I'm choosing to do them. No one's forcing me to. And that shift actually really helps in decreasing compassion fatigue. The second perception shift that I wanted to talk about today is, I am only responsible for the quality of my work and not the outcomes of my work. Now, we work with people, and people are often very willing to give us responsibility and credit for making changes in their lives. In reality, we cannot change people's lives. They change their own life. We do quality work. And if they decide that they want to take it in and use it to help them, that's their choice. If they choose not to, it doesn't mean that we're the worst professional there is. It means that they chose not to, and they have that right. I like to think of my brother. He works in a warehouse. He moves boxes all day. And when he puts a box somewhere, he can come in the next morning and it's still there. So he is responsible for the outcome of the work of moving boxes. But we work with people, and we can move them to a mindset or a position quite effectively. But when we come in the next morning, they may no longer be in that mindset. Is that our fault? Of course not. We are responsible for the quality work of putting them there. We're not responsible for them staying there. And that's all we can hold ourselves accountable for. And that mind shift also helps decrease compassion fatigue. You just do the best that you can and hope that they'll choose to continue doing it. The third one is perception shift of, I am only entitled to live my values of helping others and nothing else. You see, sometimes because we are so giving and we do so much for a lot of people, we get a little sense of entitlement. And we think, I spend my whole day caring for people, and the only thing that I want from you is this one thing, and I deserve it. You should give that to me. And when you don't, I get frustrated. So what we say is that you're not entitled to anything. The only thing you can be entitled to is the ability to just go and do your job and help people, and what a wonderful thing that is. But they're not entitled to give you anything back in return, and neither is anyone else around you. That perception also helps decrease compassion fatigue. There are several more, but that will give you a good start. Because of time, we don't have the ability to go over all of them. Now, the fourth compassion fatigue antibody is connection and support. Research showed that doctors recovered better and faster from compassion fatigue when they had a peer that they could talk to about their compassion fatigue symptoms. And this conversation is not a venting session. Venting about an issue actually makes things worse, not better. So to do it correctly, what you want to do is choose and train 3 to 4 different compassion fatigue buddies. That's what we call them. And reach out to them and say something like, "Hey, I work in the helping profession, and because I do, I'm at high risk for developing compassion fatigue. And I was wondering if you could be my compassion fatigue buddy and allow me to talk to you in times when I'm feeling emotionally drained. I promise that I won't grab you in the hallway and just vomit my trauma all over you. I will make an appointment to meet with you, and I ask that you would make time for me within 24 to 48 hours. All I need for you to do is listen to me describe what's causing me stress and the symptoms of compassion fatigue that I'm having, and then simply ask me only one question. Did you handle this situation according to your values? Allow me to think about that and respond. This will allow me to stay on track and eliminate or resolve any breaches of integrity that are causing me stress. Because most of the time, that is what's causing me stress. And hey, if you're my compassion fatigue buddy, I'll be yours too." That kind of conversation is the best kind of support that you can get. And it's important that you rotate your compassion fatigue buddies so that you're not always going to the same one every time. That's why you have 3 or 4. And people tell me that it's much more relieving than just a regular venting session like they expected. Now, the last antibody is called self-care. And this is one of that most people actually know something about. And when I say self-care, they often think of like bubble baths, chocolates, taking vacations. But while I advocate for all those things, because I think they are great, I love them too, I'm actually thinking about a different type of self-care, the kind where I want you to not just do the thing that you love, but I want you to do the thing that you know you should be doing to take care of yourself, but you're not, because it's that thing that's causing you guilt. For example, if you love to hike, that's great. It's a really good physical activity, helps keep you sane, so keep doing it. But in the physical domain, it's not what will be the most powerful at decreasing your compassion fatigue. Because maybe you really struggle with eating right. Then that's the one that I would like you to focus on. Because as you do it, you'll find yourself much more emotionally engaged because you'll feel less and less guilty. Now, there are 6 domains of self-care: physical, spiritual, social, intellectual, psychological, and financial. I'll say those again: physical, spiritual, social, intellectual, psychological, and financial. I want you to think about each domain and what you think you should be doing in each area that you're not. Then pick one of the domains and start working on that item until it becomes more of a habit. And then choose a second domain and start working on that. We just do one at a time. Once you can get those things taken care of, they will definitely help decrease your compassion fatigue. Now, compassion fatigue, burnout, and secondary traumatic stress awareness has really come a long way since the days of World War II, and even since the Vietnam War, thanks to the work of Charles Figley and Dr. Gentry and others. We are very fortunate that we can do our jobs and help traumatized populations heal without having any negative effects on ourselves. What this means is that we really can change the world and ourselves for the better because of what we do. So I challenge you to tell somebody else about what you heard today so that they can do the same thing too. If we can keep ourselves from experiencing the negative effects of helping, we'll be able to help so many more people for many, many more years to come. Thank you. Now I'd like to open it up for a few questions.
Wow, that was really informative. Wow, fantastic. This is very, I can't believe it's taken, you know, until 1995 for this to become solidified. So anyone who has a question, please press star 6 and you will get in the queue. And I can select you to answer a question. And while we're waiting for those to come in, I love this idea of antibodies. That was a very clever thing.
Yes.
And you say, so this book you're working on, I presume, goes into lots more detail.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it has exercises and activities you can do for each one of these antibodies.
Wow.
And I'm hoping that it will be out pretty soon. It's very close to being finished. So I'll notify you guys at Imagery International, and you can send out an email when it's ready.
Yeah, because I'm going to write an article based on, you know, this talk today, and then hopefully the link for the book, I can include
mm-hmm.
that.
Yep.
Now, on this compassion fatigue buddy thing, and you said, you know, not to vent, but to talk about what is causing the stress. Mm-hmm. And I loved, well, so there's a fine line between that and venting. So if you're talking about what's causing the stress and venting, mm-hmm. I think, do you have any guidelines on how do you regulate yourself to know when you're venting or when you're just simply, you know, validating
yeah.
or, you know, talking about?
That's a great question. I'm glad that you asked that one. So venting involves another person responding to you in a way that actually makes your anger worse.
Right.
So, for example, I would say, I'm so frustrated because so-and-so said this and this and this and this. And then the other person would respond and go, oh, me too. They've said that to me too. And then I go, yeah, I know. And then we each just gradually get a little bit angrier. Right?
That escalates it, yeah.
And it escalates it, yeah. And it just keeps going on and on and on. So venting is about the other person's response. So it's okay for you to say, I'm so frustrated because
I see.
Someone
okay.
said this and this and this, right? But the other person just needs to listen and not add on to that conversation or
uh-huh.
say things
so the
that
venting
would make
was
you
more about the responder. Okay,
mm-hmm.
very good.
Yes.
And what is the question that you had? Did you handle the situation to the best of your values? Is that the right question?
Yes. Yeah, did you handle the situation according to your values?
According
which takes
to
you mm-hmm, which takes you back to intentionality. And it also encourages you to accept accountability and responsibility for your part in what happened instead of blaming someone or something else. Venting blames, right? Where this says, no, what did you do? Did you handle it the way that you felt like you should? Right.
Neat. And mm-hmm. then the values kind of come in number two, and intentionality.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. So it takes you back to that. Most of the time what you'll discover in these conversations is that there was a perceived threat. You were experiencing a sympathetic dominance for your sympathetic nervous system. So you were acting impulsively and you usually said something or did something that was against what you valued. And
uh-huh.
because of that, that is what created the compassion fatigue or stress. So when your buddy reminds you about that, well, so did you live according to your values? Did you handle it well? Then you can kind of go, oh, I guess I didn't. And why didn't you? Well, because I was perceiving a threat and I wasn't relaxing my body enough that I could actually take control of how I responded in that situation.
Wow, these are really excellent tips on what we can do in the presence of clients when we're feeling that stress. You gave such great things about the vagus nerve, and I had heard that even just putting your tongue to the right behind your front teeth, that also can calm the vagus nerve. Is that anything you remember?
I've heard that as well. It's probably because the vagus nerve is right there in the roof of your mouth.
Mm-hmm. But yawning is more profound. Like when I put my tongue to the, that doesn't do as much as the yawning. Yeah. And then the pelvic thing reminds me of Kegels. Have you ever heard of Kegels?
Yes. Yes. Yep. Other people have told me it's similar to that. Yep.
So
very
all
powerful.
Of us women can do that. And then that the focus, the widening, the focus, that is another thing. So I felt all three of those when I tried those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the perceptual, the widening your perceptual vision, it really is one that most people don't think about, but it works really well. So just, you know, looking in your peripheral.
So I'm not getting any questions, so please, somebody, don't feel shy. Press star 6. I believe it's star 6 on your phone. What I can even do is I will just unmute, just in case if the star 6 isn't working. I am going to see if I can figure out how to unmute people, and that way if they have a question they can ask. All right, I'm unmuting.
And I can certainly give you my contact information, so if you have questions that you think of later, you can feel free to email me or give me a call. I'm happy to help answer.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll include your email with the follow-up email that I'll send to all the people who signed up with the recording and give them your email so they can ask you.
Mm-hmm. That would be great.
Okay.
Does anybody
Hello?
Have any questions? You can just, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Lori, and I wanted to ask you a question about when you were talking about the symptoms for the secondary trauma. I was also looking at the compassion fatigue symptoms, and many of them overlap. So, how would you know which one it is to get the right kind of help for that?
That is a really good question. It is possible for someone to have both compassion fatigue and secondary trauma. But I think of secondary trauma similar to like post-traumatic stress disorder. So if you know anything about that, it's actually the same symptoms of that, where it's unexplained heightened alarm. Like a soldier who comes home from war might hear a car backfire and think it's a gun going off, and they'll dive under a table, and then they'll feel embarrassed about it because they know that there really wasn't any danger. Secondary traumatic symptoms are like that. They're unexplained. You know you shouldn't be thinking that in that moment, but you still are, you know. Whereas compassion fatigue symptoms, you can be like, well, I know that I've really been stressed about this case, and so that's why I'm thinking about it or doing this. But so the secondary traumatic stress are more intrusive. They pop into places where they shouldn't be. And that's why they're bothersome. Nightmares or thoughts when you're in the shower or you're supposed to be playing with your kids and you can't focus on it. Those kinds of things.
Okay, thank you so much. That helps.
You're welcome. Glad you asked.
I liked your, I am only responsible for the quality of my work. Was it, did you say, not the outcome of my work?
Not the outcome.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's a really important one because I think we really want people to get better when they come see us, right?
We really have to release our responsibility and allow them to own their own life.
That's right. Yep. Mm-hmm. And not hold ourselves accountable if they're not getting better, because then we beat ourselves up and then we start to say, oh, I must not be good at this job, and then it becomes more emotionally draining, where instead saying, I did good work, right? And I am responsible for the quality of my work. So if I didn't do good work, then I better be fixing that, because that's important, you know. But the fact that whether they're getting better or not, it's not just up to me. There's a lot of other factors involved in that.
That's fantastic. I mean, if you even just, that almost seems like, you know, if you keep that in mind as you're working with people already, that's shielding you from potential mm-hmm. compassion fatigue right there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, it's really powerful when you,
like, these aren't
that.
In, like, chronological or, like, the most important mm-hmm. self, right? It's like, these aren't, like, in order of importance. They're all equally mm-hmm. Working together, right?
Yeah, and they're shifts that, if you talk to people who've been in the field a long time successfully, they'll tell you that, you know, that there was a time when they started where they felt a huge sense of responsibility for the outcomes, almost that they yeah. wanted to go home and follow clients around with a pillow to make sure that the client never did anything to harm themselves, you know. And then as they matured in the field, they realized that's not possible, right? And so they're able to disconnect themselves from that demand. So I think if that's what helps you be able to do well in the profession and not have compassion fatigue, we should be teaching these perceptions a lot younger, a lot sooner, you know, right when we first get in the field, right?
Oh,
helping them shift. Yeah.
Yeah, because this is dangerous. This is, mm-hmm. I mean, I was stunned by the statistics. I believe you said it was by the APA
mm-hmm.
of the statistics of, I mean, yeah.
I know, and they did that study, the APA did, because they had a prominent member of their board who committed suicide, a prominent psychologist.
Wow.
And so all the psychologists who were on the board were like, how could we miss that? We were good friends with this person, and he was a psychologist. We should have seen the signs. And so that...
Whoops. Well, I think we've lost Mariette somehow. So I will end the call. Thank you all for calling in. If you have any questions, email us, or you can respond to the email that I will send out. This was a fascinating talk. Thank you so much, Mariette. I'm sorry we got cut off, but it's after 5 anyway. So bye to you all, and thanks for joining us tonight.